Hello and welcome everyone to my very own podcast. This is John Book and it is the first show of 2013. I welcome the 12 of you and hope that you enjoy today's show. It's a good one. Got a really, really good interview coming up with Stephen Donnelly, a guy who's a leader in the church that I work in here in Sheffield. And that's kind of the bulk of our episode today. But first, just some updates and a review for you. Hope you all had a really good Christmas and New Year's. I was sick most of the week that I had off, which was kind of unfortunate. January has kicked off to a really intense month so far. Intense in mostly good ways, but just a lot is happening. The year originally was shaping out where we had kind of a relaxed winter and then a busy spring getting ready for our training school outreach. Ira and I co-lead, along with some other amazing people, the Antioch School of Transformation. We have 6 students this year, and the culmination of the school, the end of the school, is going to be an overseas trip in July and August. Well, we found out that there's 2 people in the school who are married to each other, found out that they were pregnant and due at the time we were supposed to do the outreach. So after thinking and praying and talking and looking at everything, we have moved that outreach up to the Easter break, which is the first 2 weeks of April. So we have basically, I think it's 9 or 10 weeks now to raise $5,000 for our family and another $10,000, I think, for everybody else at least, to go on our outreach. And we are actually thrilled to be able to go to Lebanon and another country in the Persian Gulf. I've been to Lebanon before. Spent about 30 hours there in 2004. I found it amazing. Beirut is a beautiful city on the Mediterranean. Was there visiting some of our workers, filming interviews and things like that. And I just found Beirut to be a fascinating place. I'll tell you a couple of stories. One is we were walking, there's a downtown area that's quite kind of posh and built up. It's got huge Starbucks, Hard Rock Cafe, all these outdoor cafes. It's right on the coast. You know, hear the waves of the Mediterranean coming in. Wandering around that area, I found this one spot, and I kind of looked around me, and I thought, somehow this spot sums up this country. Looking right to left, on my right, there was an old shell of a building covered in bullet holes. I was standing on a bridge, and at the bottom of the bridge below me was the excavations of some old Roman ruins. And on the other side of that, beyond the bridge, there was the steeple of a church. And sticking out above the church from behind it was the minaret of a mosque. And to my left, on the other side of the bridge, was a TGI Fridays. Somehow that sort of sums up that city to me. And then we had a really interesting time going to another part of town, the sort of Hezbollah-controlled part of town. And we went to this one Palestinian refugee, camp. It was a refugee camp, but it's really a bunch of refugees living in these sort of incomplete buildings. We weren't really allowed to go in. It wasn't entirely safe. But on the outskirts, on the boundaries of the refugee camp, they had these giant posters of faces with Arabic writing. And I asked the driver, whoever was driving me around, what are those posters? And it's like, oh, those are people from this area who have died giving themselves as suicide bombers, and it's in honor of them. I thought, this is not what I'm used to. And they said, take some pictures, but make sure no one sees you. Kind of lay back low in the car. And yeah, it was pretty intense. I also got to take pictures from a balcony of a NGO that worked with people from that camp, and I met this kid there. I think he just turned 19 years old, and he'd grown up in that refugee camp, and so for his birthday, they took him to downtown Beirut, and he had culture shock. He'd never seen anything so nice within the same city. It was kind of crazy, and they said, go out into the balcony. You can take pictures across the street into the camp, but if anyone sees you, come back inside immediately because they might have a gun. And so I snapped some quick pictures and ran back inside. Still have those pictures. But yeah, Beirut is amazing. We're going to go there, and then we're going to this other Persian Gulf country. And as far as I know, we are the first Antioch team to ever do a short-term trip there. We've had other things happen in that city, but never a short-term trip, and I'm really excited about that. So that's happening in April, but before that, in February, we're taking a 2-day trip to Lyon, France, to hopefully meet with some church leaders and pray about church planning in that city. And then in May, we hope to take a holiday to the Haven. We are taking a holiday to the Haven in Portugal, which is Antioch's member care sort of retreat center run by Scott and Jenny Robinson. It'll be nice, it'll be warm, it'll be beachy. We are very excited about the rest that we'll get there. So that's been crazy. A lot of stuff is happening. Nadia turned 5 yesterday, the day before I'm recording this. Joshua turns 2 later this week. Both of them are amazing and a handful and hilarious and love being a dad. Yeah, so that's an update on here. Now, in cultural news, sort of the big thing that's been going around, everyone's been talking about, everyone's really been into, is the movie of Les Miserables. And forgive me if you're not into musicals, it's going to get nerdy for a few minutes here. But it came out 2 weeks ago. It came out later here than it did in the States. And Les Mis, the musical, has run on the West End in London for something like 20 years. You know, it closed in New York and has even had a revival that's open and closed since then. But it has never closed in London, and it is still consistently popular. And there's something just very English about it. Something, even though it's a French, you know, story taking place in France, the English love this musical. So it was a really big deal when the movie came out. We went opening night. And yeah, I really like the musical. I've seen it 5 times on the stage. It was really fascinating to me just to watch the ways that they've changed it. They tweaked a lot of things. Some of the tweaks I think were really good. You know, they rewrote some lines and shortened some songs and added some bridge bits. And a lot of those I feel like made the plot a little bit more understandable. When you see it on the stage, things just sort of fly by. And the last 15 or 20 minutes I find especially confusing in terms of like the characters' motivations and why Jean Valjean won't go to Cosette's wedding and what happened in the sewer and the ring and all that. It gets a little muddled. And why Marius feels upset that he left Valjean and then et cetera, et cetera. And in the movie, they sort of cleared it up. And I think part of that was because they rewrote it, but also part of it was you're seeing things up close. You're seeing the characters' reactions, and it changed the dynamics of some of the songs and made some of the story clearer. For like the song, for example, whatever it's called, Red, the Blood of Angry Men, that song. In the stage version, it's just a cool song, but in the movie, it clearly becomes an argument. Not a heated one, but kind of a back and forth discussion between the leader of their little revolutionary band and Marius, who's just fallen in love, and he's trying to sway the rest of the guys, and then they sway him back. Just found that really interesting. Some of the changes I did not like as much. For example, I don't know if you noticed, but they moved the song On My Own by with that Eponine sings up to earlier in the musical. Now, the big I Dreamed a Dream song that Anne Hathaway sings, they moved it to later. In the stage production, she sings it right after getting fired. And here they moved it to after she's already like given herself over to prostitution. And that change actually made a huge difference. It made it much more powerful. The Eponine song, they moved On My Own up. First of all, I've always kind of cringed at that song because it seems like every Baylor girl, that was their favorite song. As if like some guy had wronged them and never noticed them, and they were all really connecting with Eponine, and I just made me kind of roll my eyes, if I'm honest. But they moved it up to just after you've met that character, and so it loses some of its power because you haven't seen the ins and outs of how she relates to Marius. You've just met her and seen like one or two scenes of her relating, and I feel like it weakened the song to a degree. So interesting changes. Overall, I thought the cast did a fantastic job. Eddie Redmayne made me actually like Marius. I thought he was really good. I am one of the vocal minority who actually really liked Russell Crowe as Javert. I realize he's a non-traditional Javert. He doesn't have that sort of booming, powerful, I guess, tenor voice that Javert usually has. Instead, he's kind of more of a rock and roll, rock opera style singer. But I feel like his performance, he maintained this rigidity throughout. except for in the moments where the cracks start to appear, and I feel like he really sold that dynamic of Javert's personality. I really liked him in the role. I thought Hugh Jackman was fantastic. I think he could win an Oscar. He could upset Daniel Day-Lewis out of it. I didn't always like his singing. I feel like he did this strange bleedy thing with his voice a few times too often. But most of it I really enjoyed. But for me, most of all, it's the story. There's a line in Javert's last song, the big scene that he has on the bridge, where he says, "It's either Valjean or Javert." And I feel like that sums up the story. We've got two ways of looking at the world. One of them is the Inspector Javert way, where everything is about law and performance. You only reap what you sow. There's no room in his worldview for the idea of grace and for the idea of change. If you're a lawbreaker, if you've done something wrong, you deserve to be punished and watched for life. And Valjean breaking his parole is a sign not that he's trying to start a new life, but that he is a continual threat and will always be a criminal. And then there's the Valjean worldview, the one of grace instead of law, the one that forgiveness is possible and turning over a new leaf and doing right and doing good. And it seems like those are really, really clear things, but I've kind of realized how much I swing back and forth in my life. I want to live by grace with people, but I sometimes have a very Javert worldview in the way that I treat people. I want them to be a certain way. If they don't live up to my expectations, of what they should be as a Christian and where they are in life, then I judge or I withdraw myself a little bit. I think it is either law or grace, but sometimes we try and mix them too much. We want too much grace for ourselves and not enough for the people around us. And the story really challenges me. I love the idea that loving another person is to see the face of God, which reminds me of the Matthew 25 or 26 parable of the sheep and the goats, like whatever you did for the least of these. I think it's a powerful story, and the film version, I enjoy the stage version slightly better overall. The film version is excellent, and one of the best film versions of a stage musical that I've ever seen. Go see it if you haven't. It is PG-13 though, just to, there are some things. Don't really like what they did with Master of the House, as a last thought. I think they ruined the bombastic, is it D? Is that a real word? Of the song. In exchange for visual humor. Anyway, that's it. Les Mis, go see it. Coming up next, Stephen Donnelly. Like mist on the ridge, breathe it in, breathe it out. Salt in my mouth gives me hope that I'll be something worth bleeding out. Breathe it in, breathe it out. Salt in my mouth gives me hope that I'll be something worth bleeding out. Rock it on, rock it on, rock it on, rock it on, rock it on. All right, my guest today is Stephen Donnelly. He's here with me in the studio. And by studio, I mean the free room that we could find in the church. Stephen is on staff with our church. He's the student pastor. He also helps lead worship and does a lot of production stuff. He's an amazing musician. He's also going through the training school right now. How's that going, Stephen?
It's going all right. It's challenging, for sure.
It's
I'm not
good.
Sure I'm a fan of the leader, but...
Yeah, he's kind of a jerk.
Yeah.
It is currently negative, I think, 72 outside, and we are bundled up in jumpers, that's British for sweaters, and scarves and jackets and all sorts of things. But I mainly wanted to talk to Stephen today. Steve, I mainly wanted to talk because I'm actually quite fascinated by some of the stories from the way that you were brought up. I know that you, for the first several years of your life, there was no TV. Just describe that to me. I want to kind of hear.
Well, this is kind of a weird topic. A guy I used to work with thought I was Amish for a long time, just because, yeah, I had a strange upbringing in some ways and a great one in other ways. It was just very normal for me. Yeah. We didn't have a TV. We didn't have radio. We spent a lot of time reading and being creative. My mum used to give us loads of creative projects, so we learned to paint and cook and knit. It's very useful.
From how old? Like, what ages was this?
I mean, this was from as young as I can remember. I started playing the piano when I was 3, which my parents always said they were, I mean, they told me later on, they decided that I would play the piano once I started to read. And so we read early because we didn't really have anything else to do, and my parents would talk to us a lot and just read to us. And
did both of your parents work at that time?
No. My dad worked a lot. He would come back in the evenings and read stories and play with us sometimes, but he was away a lot. My mum, who was a teacher, she had a whole load of time off work once my sister and I were born, and we're only 16 months apart, so she had quite a bit of time off until we both went to school, and then she went back to work again. So,
yeah, I absolutely, I love this about your upbringing. But as like with a 5-year-old, well, next week they'll be 5 and 2. Like we tend to use, and we didn't really want it to be this way necessarily, but we tend to use like a video or something as a way to free us up to cook dinner or do a little cleaning or whatever, almost like a babysitting tool, which I think is a slightly better way to use it than just using it because you don't want to play with your kids or whatever and you just have better things to do. Like we use it when we really have to. But I just can't figure out how, like, I have no idea how we would parent both of these kids if we didn't have stuff like that. Like, how did she do it?
I mean, she used to, because from such an early age, and I think Nadia does this a lot, and I think Josh does as well, we were very, very creative. We just learned to play outside or in the house with toys, and we'd play with each other, and we'd just create games. I remember my sister would, like, we used to play church together. She would be the vicar. The pastor, and I would be the congregation. I'd fulfill all other roles, which basically was an opportunity for her to boss me around. But we would like
was this Esther?
No, this was Ruth. She's my older sister. Esther wasn't born at this point. And we had stairs with wooden slats on it, so we used to use those as pews. And there was like an open gap in between each step, so you could put your legs through. So we'd sit there, and we had these old hymn books, and she would like. We'd have to sing the hymns together. We'd baptize our little soft toys in the laundry basket. Like we would just be very creative with our time. So I remember doing that a lot, but I remember Mum would use some of the craft and creative things, I think, as a way for her to then go out and do something else in the kitchen or whatever. And so she would, like, she'd give us paper and some pens and we'd just colour for a bit. Or I remember she used music quite a bit. She used to have these story tapes that she would use, which I guess is the equivalent of TV, and in some ways it was for us, but it would be like a whole piece of classical music, but there was a story that had been woven in with it,
like Peter and the Wolf kind of.
Yeah, so Peter and Wolf was one of the ones we had, which is an obvious one, and there was like a narrator that went with it. But then there was ones for like the Planets Suite by Gustav Holst. Like there was like a story of some kids and they went off and visited all these different planets, and so we'd just listen to that and be listening to music at the same time. I remember doing things like that.
My sister and I used to, we're three years and 3 months apart. We used to make up plays and theatrical performances, and one of our favorites was to do a fake newscast where one of us would be the newsman and the weather, and we'd just make up stuff. And we even did a soap opera once, but I got in trouble for kissing my sister. So it was part
Lightly
of it.
So.
Yes, yes. But it was part, it had to happen for the story. It was, anyway. I think she's blocked that out of her mind.
Still dealing with it now.
Yeah. But how, you started picking up the piano when you were 3. Was that something you wanted to do, or did they start giving you, like, hire a teacher to give you lessons? How did that work?
Yeah, they did eventually. I don't really remember much of it because I was very young. My mum would teach me bits, and because she played the piano very well, she would play, and I used to just sit and listen to her. So there was already like a thing about music inside of me where I wanted to listen to music. And I think there was something peaceful about it, and I wanted to play the things that she played. That was a big motivation for me. I used to listen to pieces of music. I distinctly remember some of them, which I play today. And I'd listen to them and think, wow, this is so beautiful. I wish I could do that. And that was my motivation to then to carry on learning. And so I had teachers when I was like 5, 6 onwards, really. But for the first few years I didn't. I just listened to them and then just mess around.
How in the sort of main formative years, how much did you practice?
I'd struggle to remember, really. I don't remember playing, particularly when I was very young. I don't remember playing every day. I'd play what I need to, but I think there was definitely a natural ability, which meant I didn't need to try very hard in order to play the things that I was supposed to do. I think probably when I was around 7 or 8, I started to pick up other pieces of music that my mum had, and I would play them instead of practicing. And that's when I think the real shift happened, because no, I didn't practice anymore, but I would play every piece of music I could get my hands on. And I'd just attempt them. And I would spend hours after school and just playing because I liked it and because it was something new. I loved the new sounds that I would be able to create. So it kind of went from there. I just kept playing.
So you just mess around on the Rock 3
Yeah, I mean, I played that when I was 5,
and
but
So
that was.
when you, I mean, I assume you have friends and stuff at that age, like kids from
Well,
classes. No.
yeah, I totally did.
So when you would go to their houses and like was there a part of you that like, oh, I'm missing out. I want to go to their house 'cause we'll watch TV, or was it just not interesting to you? Like curious how your attitude was towards other families
Well,
and stuff.
because I was so sheltered in some ways. I remember this must have been one of the first things I ever watched, and it was at school. And I was probably 5 or 6, so I was in reception year one. And it was Baa Baa the Elephant. And I just distinctly remember this. I was so sheltered and so sensitive to everything that I honestly couldn't cope with the film. I remember there was some like rhino guards that came and like took him away, and I was so upset I cried and I had to be taken out of the room, because there was just a sensitivity in me from not seeing images like that and knowing how to respond to like emotive music in the middle of this thing that's happening
Right.
on screen. And it was in some ways it was the same when I went to people's houses. I was so unused to it. I would get transfixed by the TV, but also would feel very sensitive to it and was very impressionable to what was on it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like Nadia has seen videos since she was 1 or 1.5, but and Joshua from younger than that. But we're really, really protective about what they watch. And so when, like, even things that seem like there was an episode of Charlie and Lola where they were, or no, this Russian cartoon where they were playing doctor and it was just meant to be really silly, but she got really freaked out. This was just last week, because we've protected her from really intense and dark things. So even when it starts to approach that, she doesn't know how to handle it. But I think that's good, actually, to a degree. I don't know. What do you think?
With the sensitivity, or
Yeah, I want her to be sensitive enough to.
it's hard because at some point you end up going into the world, and if you're so sheltered that nobody, like, you can't relate to people if you don't understand something about difficult things, I guess. My parents always said, and I think this kind of connects, they said the first 11 years of the child's life, you really get to input and say exactly what happens. But beyond that, it gets very, very different, because they suddenly get exposed to all these other things in
I would
life
say it's
that you don't
younger
have the
now than it
control
used to
over.
be.
Yeah, it probably is. I think, I mean, for them as well, there was something about discipline in that, like, they would be very firm on us until we were 11.
She was at a birthday party last week. Now she's 4 still. And she won the big game. And the prize was a box of like practical joke things, including like a bloody finger with a nail through it and like fake poop and stuff like that. I'm like, that's. We hit it. She hasn't remembered that she won it or throwing it away. But yeah, it's yeah. I think it's younger and younger what they get exposed to these
Yeah,
days.
definitely. I don't remember when the shift happened for me. I think it's weird now sometimes. I don't feel very unaware of what goes on around me. So I don't feel like those first few years where I was so sensitive, I don't feel in the same way anymore. I'm able to, and this is both a good and a bad thing, I'm able to take things in on a totally different emotional level. And for it to be okay, if something's very, very difficult, and I'm okay with it, not to bypass it, but just to be, you know, this isn't going to like ruin my life, the fact that I've just kind of seen these things. But I honestly don't really know when that shift happened. Probably some point in my teens, but
So at some point you guys did get a TV.
Yeah, we did. And it was around 11, 12 years old. But we didn't watch it very much. We'd watch sport. We'd watch films. My parents were very protective over what films we could watch. Even when we were old enough to watch 12s and 15 rated films, we often wouldn't watch them.
Mine were too, and I'm actually really grateful for it.
Yeah.
Do you, was there a specific reason why they decided to get a TV at that point?
I think they realized that at some point we had to have a point of connection with people around us. I remember my older sister, she and I are very, very different. I'm very sociable and had a lot of friends, and she is very introverted and quite private, and so she only had a few friends. And that's kind of the way she liked it. But she found it very difficult at school trying to relate to people because most people by that age just talk about things on TV. And we didn't have any point of contact. I think it's harder for a girl because when you're at school, you don't go outside and play football or anything like that. Guys just go off and do sport and
Get
mess
into
around,
things.
and you know, there's just not the same kind of pressure to have to talk that girls have. And I think maybe part of the reason why we got a TV was for Ruth, so that she would really have a point of connection in a new way because. Yeah, it was hard for her.
So tricky because you want, like, you want your family to be countercultural in a way, like kingdom culture and not world culture. And you want to protect them from things. And I've seen this done really, really well in a couple of the families back in Texas, and where the kids grow up so secure and so able to like love and serve others that it doesn't bother them that they don't understand what this movie or that music is about. Like they'd really prefer not to know, but they're still relatable enough. But they even in that place, they still struggle with rejection and things like that because they don't meet the other kids on that level. I guess that's always going to be part of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know if you can get rid of that. I mean, everybody, they're the questions you ask when you're growing up, aren't they? Like, how do I fit in? How do I make friends? And I remember my parents would say to us that we, because we're Christians, we're different to everybody else. And that was a really, it was a big theme for me in growing up. And so I never fully understood why we didn't have a TV, except to say that we were Christians and we were different and that's just the way it was. And so I definitely, as part of my identity, knew that I wasn't like other people. I don't know if I really was able to draw the line in to then say, this is why we don't have a TV, because we value purity and because we want to fix our eyes on something that is more important than the stuff that's kind of thrown out on TV. And if I understood that, but
It's really hard for a young child to understand
yeah,
if
well, yeah, exactly. And my parents may have communicated it. I don't know. I honestly don't remember. But I remember knowing that we were different, and it was because we were Christians. And that was a point of sensitivity in itself. There was a lot of moments in my childhood where, if anybody ever said anything about being a Christian in a negative way, that was a huge point of sensitivity for me. I could get upset very fast. I think because a lot of my identity was placed in that, that was a real point of rejection for me.
I can understand why that would be a sensitive place, but I think there's also fruit in living that way. I think, just to kind of wrap up, I think some of the fruit that I've seen in your life and the life of, well, I've met Esther a few times. I don't think I've met Ruth. Ruth, right?
Ruth, yeah.
Is just you do like you do have a lot of ability to read a complicated novel or process difficult thoughts and play complicated pieces of music. And I don't know that that would have been there from an early age. You spent half your time watching stupid cartoon characters, do you think? You know what I'm saying? Like it, I think that stuff decreases our attention span and our ability to process complicated information. And there's not just spiritual fruit, but just kind of like quality of life fruit as well.
Definitely. And I really think that many people have it in them, and maybe, I mean, it's choices you make when you're a little kid that, or that maybe your parents make that often determine some of those things, you know, the ability to process complicated things. It still baffles me that I can look at a piece of music and my fingers seem to know what to do without thinking. It's like reading a book for me, and that is bizarre. And I don't think any of that is because I have some ridiculous talent over anybody else. It's just at some point when I was really young, made some choices to learn to do that.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, if a kid was brought up in a home where people spoke two languages, they'd end up being bilingual when they're older, just as a natural byproduct of it.
Let's hope so.
I think they will.
Yeah, yeah. Well, to finish here, we are going to play Top of the Head. So, you ready?
Yep.
All right. Listen to no music except for boy band pop, or lose the ability to play instruments. Which one would you?
I'd listen to boy band pop every time. I can't take away my ability to play instruments. Okay. That'd be horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, your turn.
Okay. Sorry, I'm just going to choose out.
Steve mostly listens to boy band pop anyway.
Who would play you in a movie of your life?
Well, most people would instantly think George Clooney. or they would think the guy who played Napoleon Dynamite.
I can see both of those things.
Yeah.
I was thinking more Keanu Reeves, maybe. I feel like he's a good fit for you.
I don't know.
He's definitely got your personality.
What? I'm insulted. Not cool. Whoa, dude. Okay. Okay, off of the top of my head, Matt Damon for some reason.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, your turn. What is the strangest thing you've ever eaten? Most unusual?
I don't know if I've eaten anything ridiculously unusual. I mean, I've had a horse, I've had a rabbit. I don't think they're particularly unusual. They probably are in our society, but that's probably as weird as it gets.
Okay, what about disgusting then?
Without a doubt. Yeah. The nastiest alcoholic drink in Zambia. It's maize flour, homebrew, beer in a petrol can. And it was lumpy, and it was thick, and it was horrible.
In a petrol can, just sort of somehow.
That tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, that was nasty. Unforeseen or sloppy wet.
Depends on the mood, really. I think no, I'm just kidding. in the song, I think I would prefer sloppy wet.
Wow,
I don't know what unforeseen
controversial
means. I know. What is your favorite novel or the best novel you've ever read? Novel.
Stealing my questions.
You can ask me the same.
Best novel I've read, just because I couldn't put it down. The Count of Monte Cristo. Just a good read of a novel. I really enjoyed that.
Is that Dumas?
Yeah, Alexandre Dumas.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
It is on my Kindle, but I have not yet read it.
You should read it. It'll take you a while. Same question to you. What is your favorite book? Except mine was a novel, so you've got a slightly broader.
I have two favorite books. And so one is The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, very good.
Because I think the heaven and hell stuff isn't so much the point to me as it is looking at all these humans who are making excuses why they're not going to follow God. And, like, it felt like it was so insightful.
Yeah.
The red lizard and the tragedian and the woman who wants to control her son. And anyway.
Yeah.
And then A Prayer for Owen Meany by John Irving. Yeah, it's like 500 or 600 pages long. The first 100 pages got taken and turned into a really stupid movie where they completely changed the ending. So I'm not going to tell you what that movie is. So in case you've seen it and you thought this is stupid and would cause you not to read the book. But it's a fantastic book.
Wow, okay.
What is one verse in the Bible that you don't understand?
Wow. Oh, that thing about Satan arguing with Michael over Moses' body. I have no idea what that's talking about.
Is that from Zechariah or whatever?
No, it's in Jude. It's right at the end of Jude.
Right.
It's like this really casual reference to some event and nobody knows what they're talking about. I have no idea how he knows that happened. Satan argues with Michael over the body of Moses. It's a really strange.
Isn't it a reference to like the Book of Enoch or something?
Maybe. I've never read the Book of Enoch. Yeah, probably should do. Yeah.
Okay, one more for me.
Okay, this is kind of a strange ethereal question.
Go for it.
So I've just finished reading The Shack again.
Mm-hmm.
Very much enjoy that book for a number of different reasons.
Uh-huh.
But in one scene in there, God opens the eyes of the main character to see creation. And everything in creation has this light that's coming out of it. And it's in different colors. And people are represented you can still see them, but they have all these colors coming off them. And each set of colors is unique to that person.
Okay.
So my question is, if you were described by a set of colors, which set of colors would it be?
If I were described by a set of colors, okay, let's have a sort of a warm blue, not too light, that sort of morphs into some bit of an aggressive purple. I'm not sure what an aggressive purple looks like.
I don't know what that means. So, <either.
laughs> so at the top of the head here, there would also be that sort of tannish orange, kind of like the colors of University of Texas, but not. Gold. There would be a lot of gold.
Wow.
All right. Thanks, Stephen. All right. That's our show for this week. If you have any feedback for us, email us. Email me at veryownpodcast@yahoo.com. And let's have a question of the week. Our question of the week is going to be, how do you fight Javert in your life? How do you fight off the law and the judgment and the lack of grace in your own life? Read some answers next time, as well as do some other interesting things. Music you've heard today has been Ethan Durrell, as always, and Bleeding Out by The Lone Bellow. Have a good day. I am blessed and blessed and blessed to have a love like this, like this, like this. Yes, I am a son of the king. I know that I'm accepted. Have a destiny and I won't be rejected. I want you to feel it, so that is why I say this. I let it out, spit these bars, making God famous. I'ma let it shine, little light of mine. Put the news on a stand and I won't let it hide. So you can come and ask and I will tell the truth. Cause my story stands before you and it's living proof. If he did it for me, then he'll do it for you. Knocking on the door, so what you gonna do? This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine.